weaving the threads of art, culture, and history. David Swatling creates an oral tapestry.
The magnificent Lorenzo de' Medici had filled his garden on the Piazza San Marco with ancient and good sculpture, so that the terraces and alleys were adorned with good antique figures in marble and with pictures and other things by the best masters in Italy. And not only were they a great ornament to the garden, but they became a school and academy for young painters and sculptors, particularly young nobles. Lorenzo always favored men of talent, but particularly nobles who had any inclination to art. So it's no wonder that some came forth from that school to astound the world. The head of this academy was Bertoldo, an old Florentine sculptor and a pupil of the great Donatello's. A 15-year-old adolescent named Michelangelo came to the garden. He set himself to imitate an ancient head of an old faun, and although he had never touched marble or chisel before, he succeeded so well that Lorenzo was quite astonished. Desiring to assist him, he sent for Lodovico, his father, and prayed him to give him his son, promising that he would treat him like a son of his own. And he willingly consenting, Lorenzo gave him a room in his house, and he ate continually at his table with his sons and noble persons who were around his magnificence. Written by the official Medici composer Heinrich Isaac, Palla 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 refers to the balls on the Medici coat of arms, and traditionally it opened the May Carnival in Florence. Lorenzo de' Medici once said, "A city is a collection of families," but it was his family which would predominate Florentine power and patronage in the second half of the 15th century, as the Italian Renaissance began to bloom. Professor Deborah Spini teaches political theory and is doing postdoctorate studies at the University of Florence.
So the city of Florence, a rich city. First, this is very important to remember. Secondly, Florence also has a particular identity because it was a city who had a long history and tradition of keeping its own liberty. Of course, one has to understand that the word liberty indeed had a very different meaning than the sort of meaning we are used to that today. The Republican government of Florence, the free government of Florence, was basically a government of a handful of powerful families. Nonetheless, it still meant that the city would perceive itself as being a free body, not directly depending from the will of one single individual. Those were also the years in which the self-perception of the city of Florence was drastically changing, because in between the political panorama of the city of Florence, there was a new actor, this very powerful Medici family. Now, the Medici are not one of the old aristocratic families. They were somehow parvenus, if you want. They were new money, but they had an awful lot of money. With this money, basically, they did manage to buy their way to power.
The Medici family, they didn't exactly come out of nowhere, but they came out of the very backwoodsy Mugello region, northeast of Florence.
Dr. Edward Goldberg is director of the Medici Archive Project in Florence.
They arrived in Florence around 1300. In the Mugello, they'd been medium-sized, almost gentleman farmers. In Florence, they began as small businessmen, became medium-sized businessmen, money changers, merchant bankers, great international entrepreneurs. Of course, in Florence, then as now, the only way to hold on to money was to hold on to power. And the only way to hold on to power was through politics. So they became richer and richer. They formed a political party. They became heads of a political faction. Then really, more or less, presidents for life.
By the time Lorenzo was born, in 1449, the Medici were already Florence's premier family, and Lorenzo entered public life early. At the age of 5, he made his first state appearance, dressed up in the French manner and accompanied by a splendid retinue. At 10, he was publicly presented as the future Medici heir and began to study rhetoric and poetics at the University of Florence. Lorenzo's intellectual side was encouraged by his grandfather, Cosimo the Elder, who played chess with the boy and allowed him to sit in on philosophical discussions with the intellectual elite. His political side was nurtured by his father, Piero de' Medici, who sent him on diplomatic missions to Milan, Naples, and Rome, where he met with Pope Paul II, who confirmed the Medici as the bankers of the Vatican. Both patriarchs were great patrons of the arts. Cosimo supported the sculptor Donatello and the architect Brunelleschi. Piero was patron to the young painter Sandro Botticelli. The young Lorenzo took a particular interest in music, and according to Fabio Lombardo, founder of the early music ensemble L'Homme Armé, he had the best teacher in the city of Florence.
Antonio Squarcialupi was organist in the Florentine Cathedral, and he was a very, very famous organ player. But we have not a composition by Antonio Squarcialupi, and he said that he was not able to compose. It's a very strange case, because his way of play was astonishing, and it is very strange that he declared that he was not able to compose. It was Squarcialupi that connected Lorenzo il Magnifico with Guillaume de Failly.
Guillaume de Failly's Homage to Florence, the Flower of Tuscany. In a letter to de Failly, Antonio Squarcialupi wrote,
"Lorenzo regards you with admiration. Because of the excellence of his divine talent, he enjoys quality in all the arts, and thus delights exceedingly in the greater refinement of your music. And for that reason, he admires your art and respects you as a father."
Lorenzo is said to have played the viol and the lute and enjoyed performing during public events, such as the May Carnival festivities. But was he a good musician? Musicologist Dr. Gianluca Lastrioli.
We don't know exactly, because as long as we know, he liked to improvise music. And of course, he has not written anything, any piece, no pieces have remained. So we only have a few descriptions of his ability as an improviser of music. And of course, we do not trust these descriptions, because nobody would have ever dared to say that he was a horrible singer and player, because otherwise he would have been, I don't know, decapitated or killed on the spot. Therefore, you know, who knows? He must have, you know, he was a man of culture, he was a poet, he was a man of letters, and so probably he was also a talented musician. But to which extent, I don't know. We don't know.
But what we do know from his own autobiography is his state of mind in early December 1469, when his father Piero died.
The second day after his death, although I, Lorenzo, was very young, being 20 years of age, the principal men of the city and of the state came to us in our house to condole with us on our loss and to entreat me to take charge of the city and the state as my grandfather and my father had done. This I did, though on account of my youth and a great responsibility and perils arising therefrom, with great reluctance, solely for the safety of our friends and of our possessions. For it is ill living in Florence for the rich, unless they rule the state. Till now we have succeeded with honor and renown, which I attribute not to prudence, but to the grace of God and the good conduct of my predecessors.
The young Lorenzo was well aware of the struggle he would have to undertake to gain the respect of Florence and of the states traditionally allied with his family, Milan and Naples. Diplomatic missions succeeded with the latter, but to ingratiate himself to the citizens of his own city, he took a different approach, according to Niccolo Machiavelli, who wrote The History of Florence.
He turned his attention to beautifying and enlarging his city. Where there were open areas without buildings, he ordered the construction of new streets filled with new buildings. As a result, the city became larger and more beautiful. In these times of peace, he always kept the city in a constant state of feasting. Tournaments and representations of historical deeds and triumphs were often presented there. His goal was to keep the city content, the people united, and the nobility respected.
As long as we can understand, Florence was at that time, you know, something like Rio de Janeiro. Today, you know, the Florentine Carnival, you know, could compete with today's Brazil Carnival. And this is, you know, the evidence of this can be found not only in literary descriptions, but also in visual sources and several other places.
Lorenzo, during his lifetime, sought to create for himself an image of being the leader of the Florentine civic government and to create an alternate power center in his own palace to the actual governmental center of the town hall in Florence.
Dr. Bruce Edelstein of the Medici Archive Project.
But in actual fact, Lorenzo was not a prince and was not even of a noble family. And it was only subsequently, under later generations of the Medici, that the myth of Lorenzo was really exploited to further the Medici's power and prestige throughout Europe. And so in the next generation, Lorenzo's son, one of his younger sons, Giovanni, who became Pope with the name of Leo X, exploited the image of his father as a great cultural patron and patron of the arts and as a great political figure.
However, there is historical evidence that he thwarted an assassination attempt against his father and later another against himself and his brother Giuliano during Mass in the Florentine Cathedral. There is also a letter he wrote to the ruling Signoria after he embarked, without official sanction, on a potentially dangerous mission to the King of Naples at the end of 1479.
Most illustrious my lords, it is not from presumption that I did not notify the reason of my departure to your illustrious excellencies, but because it seemed to me that the agitated and disturbed condition of our city demands acts and not words. I conceive that she desires and has extreme need of peace. Seeing that all other endeavors have been fruitless, I have determined to run some peril in my own person, rather than expose the city to disaster. I shall therefore carry out my idea. If it succeeds according to my wishes and hopes, I shall be most glad to benefit my country at the risk of my life.
Let's search who will for honors high and pomp, for city squares, for temples, buildings great, for wealth and pleasures which accompany a thousand bitter thoughts, a thousand woes. A small green meadow filled with lovely flowers, a little brook that bathes the plants around, a little bird lamenting for his love, much better these our burning ardor's ease. Ah, there with eager straying thoughts I see those lovely lights as if they were alive. Here, this or that thing cuts me off from them. Well, it may not be Shakespeare, but then again, perhaps it loses something in translation. However, it's clear from this sonnet that Lorenzo sometimes longed for the pastoral pleasure of his youth. Composing sonnets must have been a relaxing break from his state responsibilities, and he was a prolific writer, according to Gianluca Lastrioli.
You know, as a poet, he wrote in many different styles. He wrote, for instance, light-hearted, crisp, bouncing sonnets, and, you know, with love themes and things like that. But he also wrote spiritual things. So as a poet, I think he explored all the range of moods and styles. And in the pieces that we presume that were set to music, normally he has this light mood with strophic pieces, very clearly rhymed. You know, if I were to recite them for you in Italian, you would understand. You know, quanto è bella giovinezza che si fugge tuttavia, chi vuole essere lieto sia, di domani non v'è certezza. Tanta timpa tampa tinta, tanca tinca tanca tam, pampa riga da ga riga da ga di ga da ga da. So the music somehow is already in the text.
A song with text by Lorenzo, celebrating the charms of Florentine women. Perhaps because of his early interest and study of music, he was one of the greatest patrons of Renaissance musicians.
Yes, he was, and he protected and encouraged musicians to come to Florence, musicians that came from mostly from Northern Europe, from the Flanders, from Northern France, and he paid them very well. We still have the contracts that these musicians signed with the then administration of Florence, but it was Lorenzo himself who paid. And these contracts were very rich for the musicians. And they were paid like, well, perhaps not like rock and roll superstars nowadays, but almost. So he had, in some period, some 20 musicians working steadily for him at his court, and that is quite remarkable.
And I think Henrik Isaac would be probably his number one musician.
He was, yes. I would say we could say that he was number one. He Lorenzo privileged. He liked him very much, and probably there was a very good kind of friendship between the two of them. And so, if he were to mention one name, it would be Isaac as the typical musician that we should associate to Lorenzo's entourage.
Henrik Isaac's homage to John the Baptist, or San Giovanni, the patron saint of Florence. The city was very religious and home to many orders, the Benedictines, the Franciscans, the Servites, the Augustinians, the Carmelites, and the Dominicans, whose Florentine seat was Santa Maria Novella. It was for this church that Sandro Botticelli painted his famous Adoration of the Magi, now in the Uffizi Museum. And you don't have to look too closely to recognize Lorenzo de' Medici himself in the crowd. Professor Rab Hatfield teaches art history at Syracuse University in Florence.
I did a great deal of research on that painting, and it turns out that the painting was commissioned by a little exchange broker who had no real position at all in Florentine society, but managed to get himself a little bit of territory, we might say, in the Church of Santa Maria Novella, and he transformed that into a very simple kind of chapel for which he had this painting done. It certainly looks to me as if some of the figures in that painting represent members of the Medici family. We don't know of any particular connection between the patron in this case and the Medici, so my guess is that very possibly he had these people included in the painting as a form of ingratiating himself with them, you know, possibly hoping to get some of their business for his little exchange operation, which is about as far as he ever got.
Patrons saw art primarily as a means of glorifying themselves and the power they possessed. Dr. Bram Kempers is professor of the sociology of art at the University of Amsterdam, and in his book, Painting, Power, and Patronage, he notes that the commissions for churches and chapels by the Medici family overshadowed those of all other houses of Florence. But was patronage of religious works, or high art, more important than patronage of secular or popular forms? Dr. Kempers.
Well, you have to be careful about these terms, but I think high art and what we now sometimes call popular art were intertwined in many ways. Pamphlets, sculptures, statues, frescoes, they had a context in common, and they communicated with each other, I think. So you can't be very strict in saying that's high art and that's low art and popular art and something completely different.
At the end of the 15th century, if you think of it in terms of simple statistics, religious art was far more important still than secular art. But perhaps we could arrive at the following distinction. Works of religious art were commissioned as part of a centuries-old system, which was a way of the churches being able to decorate itself in return for compensation and support from the community at large. And perhaps we shouldn't really be speaking of patronage in this case, rather than simply a form of philanthropy that was accepted by practically everybody. Whereas the increasing interest in secular art was paid for by a very small number of extremely wealthy and usually highly educated people. And that we can think of as patronage in the true sense. In other words, a few interested persons being interested in supporting artists in creating a new kind of artistic expression.
Did the patrons, like Lorenzo, have a view of art in terms of taste and style and the development of what was happening to art at that time?
That's a very difficult question. I think the best way to answer it would be to say that from what we can see, it would seem that indeed they did. They did have some sort of concept of style and some sort of concept of what they wanted and what they didn't want. As a rule, they didn't articulate it. At least they didn't articulate it in anything that's come down to us, anything that's written.
But there were written contracts between patron and artist, spelling out the work to be done, when it should be done, and sometimes even how it should be done. Did masters like Leonardo da Vinci or Michelangelo always do what they were contracted to do? Dr. Kempers again.
Well, it was not always the same. Some artists could be told what to do more easily than others. And in the case of Michelangelo and Leonardo da Vinci, we know that things went wrong every now and then between the patron and the artist.
For example?
Well, the major decorations in the council hall, as I call it now, weren't finished. And Michelangelo had conflicts about several of his commissions, didn't finish them, finished them in a different way, or had problems about money.
And what of the fairy tale-like story with which we began, of Lorenzo, Michelangelo, and the Garden School, based on 16th-century writer and painter Giorgio Vasari's Lives of the Artists? Some art historians consider it pure fiction, but Professor Hatfield takes a more moderate view.
There does seem to be a certain amount of truth to Vasari's tale. It is not very likely that Michelangelo produced a replica of an ancient statue in just a day or two, as Vasari and Condivi also recount. But it does seem very probable that Michelangelo, in fact, was taken to the Medici Garden for training. There really was such a thing as the Medici Garden. And it's very likely also that his great talent came to the attention of Lorenzo de' Medici. Whether Lorenzo really took Michelangelo to live in his house with him is something that we can wonder about, but at the very least, Michelangelo probably was given room and board. And it does seem that he was trained as a sculptor at the Medici Garden. That's where he learned how to sculpt. He didn't start out as a sculptor originally. He started out as a painter's apprentice and then somehow moved into sculpture, and from that time always thought of himself as a sculptor rather than as a painter.
In the spring of 1492, the year Christopher Columbus set sail on his voyage of discovery, the ailing Lorenzo sent a letter to his son, Giovanni, who at the age of 13 had been made a cardinal, the youngest ever. he advised the boy on how best to deal with Pope Innocent VIII.
You will probably be asked to intercede in various matters with our Holy Father. Be cautious, however, at the beginning, to ask as few favours as possible, and not to bother him. The disposition of the Pope is to be grateful to those who do not break his ears. Bear this in mind in order not to annoy him. When you see him, talk about amusing things, and if you should be obliged to ask some favour from him, do it with all humility and modesty. This will please him and be in accordance with his nature. Keep well.
Less than 1 month later, Lorenzo il Magnifico died peacefully in the night, reportedly to the music of his friend and favorite composer, Henrik Isaac. One of his last visitors was another friend, philosopher Pico della Mirandola, for whom Lorenzo had commissioned a library, and to whom he said, "I wish that death had spared me until your library was completed." A patron to the end.
Why was Lorenzo the most famous patron?
That is a question in itself, I think. With regard to painting, it's a reputation which he might not have deserved in all respects. Partly due to Vasari, it has to do with later legend, and he became sort of romantic hero in the Florentine Renaissance, and you can doubt whether it's justified in all respects.
We all know that the Renaissance was born in Florence under Medici patronage. But where does this come from? Giorgio Vasari, who invented the Giotto myth, who invented the Medici art myth, and who did he work for? Cosimo I de' Medici, the Middle March of the Big Army. In terms of history, they had the greatest luxury that any politicians could ever have. They wrote the history books that people still believe 400-500 years later. With each generation, as the Medici state slipped one level in terms of political and economic power, art and culture mattered more and more by way of compensation.
So was he really not Lorenzo the Magnificent?
He really was Lorenzo the Magnificent in that he did manage to amass and centralize more power with the Medici family than any of his predecessors had. And magnificent actually comes from an Italian term of the day. A magnifico was somebody high up in local politics. And it's a term that continues to be used over the centuries following Lorenzo's death. So he's called Lorenzo il Magnifico, Lorenzo the Magnificent, because that's what he would have been called in his own day. We think of him as Lorenzo the Magnificent because of the myth that grew up about him being a great patron of the arts, when in fact there were other, perhaps greater patrons of the arts in Lorenzo's own day, even in his own city of Florence.
And the very last great act of the Medici family was Anna Maria Luisa, last of the Medicis, a bequest of the entire family art collections to the city of Florence. The family was out, but she knew that it was in terms of the art collections and this culture myth that they had fostered for 200 years that the family would be remembered.
After the death of Lorenzo, the garden school disappeared. Michelangelo, depressed by the loss of his beloved patron, left to study in Bologna. In his book, The History of Florence, Machiavelli wrote,
"All citizens and all the princes of Italy mourned his passing. There was no one who did not send envoys to express his grief. And the events that took place after his death showed they had good reason to be sorrowful. For no sooner had Lorenzo died than evil seeds began to grow, which no man alive could destroy, and which still continue to grow into the destruction of Italy."
Years before his death, Lorenzo had brought to Florence a Dominican friar with a powerful, prophetic manner of preaching. His sermons turned against his benefactor, but as Lorenzo lay dying, the friar spoke with him and gave him his blessing. In the years that followed, this figure would ignite a religious and political conflagration that would bring Florence to the brink of disaster. His name was Girolamo Savonarola.